body. I'm an alcoholic, and my name's Donald Henderson, because it says so right here. It's nice to be here. I'm glad I was chosen to come up and share on Friday morning, because I couldn't have handled last night. My God, there was a lot of people here. I was listening to Joe share last night, and I was trying to get a feel of where he was going with everything, you know, and I so closely identified with what was going on in his life. I'm not one of those kind of guys who can stand up here and tell you a whole bunch of a drunkalogue. I really honestly don't have much of a drunkalogue. I was passed out most of the time, so I don't remember a lot of it. I do like to talk about recovery, though. So I guess what I should do today is try to share with you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and the way it is now. My sponsor told me a long time ago that when all else fails, follow directions. Now, I often hear people, when they speak from a podium, talk about remembering their first drunk or remembering their first drink. I'm from a very large family down in southern Anne Arundel County. I had six brothers and a sister. And what we used to do in my family was, we had a right big yard, and, you know, it was out in the farm community and everything, and all the aunts and uncles and nephews and nieces and everything used to come over to my father's house to party on the weekends, and drinking in our home was something that just constantly went on. Everybody drank in the family, you know. And on Saturdays, everybody would gather around the house, and we'd be sitting out around the picnic table frying hamburgers and drinking beer, and everybody would be carrying on, and one of the little children, you know, one of the little babies, like my little brother or my sister, would start carrying on and crying, and my father would go over and fill his bottle up with beer, put the nipple back on and stick it in his mouth. So I assume that's probably how I had my first drink. I don't know. I can remember that in the family, as I started to get a little older, my father, you could set your watch by him. At 5 o'clock in the evening, he would come home. And he would pull into the driveway, and he would stick his arm out the window and hand me $2 and his stainless steel pitcher. Now, my job was, at the age of 9 and 10 and 11, was to run down to the bar, get his pitcher filled up with draft beer, and get him 3 packs of Camel. I'll never forget that as long as I live. And I would go down, and that kettle would set right on the dinner table. And any of the children who would like to have a glass of beer could go ahead and help themselves. And that's the way we lived. I remember experimenting with that, pouring myself a glass of that beer, and because my brothers were drinking it and everything, you know, so I wanted to drink it too. And I remember tasting it, and it was terrible stuff. And I didn't like it. So I didn't drink it. I drank milk. And then, I can get through my drunkalogue real quick, you know, because there's a few little highlights and nothing much happens, you know. I can remember being 14 years old and getting together with the boys, and we're just at that time in our lives where we're starting to feel our oats a little bit, you know. We're a little wild and we're a little crazy, and there was an old farmhouse down the road from my mother's place, and the little old lady that had lived there had died like a year before, and the house was just sitting there. So 8, 9 of us boys, we get on down there one day, and we decide we're going to go inside and see what we can find. It's called breaking and entering, you know, and we broke into the place and got to going through everything and looking at the old furniture and wind our way down in the basement. We get down in the basement of that house, and we found 150 gallons of homemade wine, you know. Now, we're 14, 15 years old, you know, and... Gee, this is a tremendous discovery. The old ones, you know, the gallon jugs with the cork stuck in the top of them, you know, and some of them was a dark blue and some of them was a cherry red and all that kind of stuff. And we all run home, got our wagons. And we start unloading this wine out of there, you know, and that gets it all out of the basement, gets it in the wagons, and we hauls it back in the woods. Now, the plan was that when we went back into the woods to play soldier, we was going to drink like the real soldiers. You know, and I got back here that day, and I had seen it on TV, Beverly Hillbillies or something, I don't know, where they throw the jug up on their shoulder, you know, and they start crazy, and I poured it all down me and everything, you know. But I drank an awful lot of it, and it wasn't like that beer. This stuff was wonderful. I mean, it was sweet, and, oh, God, I loved it, you know. And I drank it, and I couldn't feel anything strange happening to me until I passed out. You know, and I didn't know I was drunk or none of that kind of stuff, and I was one of those poor souls who was a Roman Catholic on top of it, and I was an altar boy, and I was supposed to serve Mass the next day, and I remember getting sick on the altar and passing out and taking a pledge at 14. You know, I'll never drink that stuff again as long as I live, you know. But I can remember when I was 15. And when I grew up, it was back in the early 50s, we had two types of people. We had people that we referred to as squares, and we had drapes. And the crowd that I hung with, we was drapes. Now, we used to wear them real pointy shoes and set pants with the saddle stitch down the side of them, and we comb our hair back in a big DA back here, and we'd wear undershirts with a pack of cigarettes rolled up on the top here, you know. Didn't matter if you smoked or not, you still rolled the cigarettes up here on your sleeve, you know. And we'd go out, and one of the older guys would have a car, and we'd hunt around town and see if we could find ourselves a wino, and we could always find one who would buy us 12 beers. We'd pitch in our money, and you could buy a six-pack then for 98 cents. And we'd get two six-packs and throw them in the back of the car, and then there would be a big argument about who was going to ride shotgun, you know, the window next to the driver. And we'd travel into the big city, and that was Glen Burnie for us, you know. And we'd ride around Glen Burnie, and you got your cigarettes piled up here, and you get your can of Budweiser in your hand, you stick your arm outside, and you pop the muscle up real big, and you whistle at the girls, and you know, hey, honey, and all that stuff. You know what the hell you was going to do if one of them ever answered you, you know. You know. But I used to like to get by that window. Not so bad. I enjoyed whistling at the girls and all. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with me. But I didn't like that beer. And I used to like, you know, I'd get over there. I could hang my arm out and sort of like spill it out, you know, as we were going down the road. That way I wouldn't have to drink it because I just didn't like the taste of it. I didn't like it. I worked hard to become an alcoholic. It wasn't easy for me. There was a lot of things I had to overcome. You know. I was in that place where I needed to fit in and I needed to be part of. I come from a large family and I always felt, and I guess anybody who is an alcoholic can identify, I always felt like I was the black sheep of the family. All my brothers and sisters would talk about strange things that I didn't understand, like love, and I had absolutely not the slightest idea what it was all about. I knew all about what it was that I wanted, and I remember being extremely sensitive. I heard someone talk about alcoholics being so sensitive, and my feelings got hurt real easy. But I needed to be part of, and I needed to fit in. Nothing much else exciting happens in my drunkalog. I went on through school and left there and joined the Navy, had a few little things going on in there, but nothing real exciting, you know, nothing that I'd even want to, I couldn't sit in the back seat of a car and share war stories with anybody, that's for sure, you know, I just would feel out of it. I can remember turning 22 years old and marrying my high school sweetheart, girl I had dated, she was 14 years old when we started dating, you know, and when I was 22 we got married and I got me a nice job and I was making pretty good money and about a year or so later, the baby started coming along, and things looked good. I bought me a nice home down in Rivera Beach, a nice community where I was born and raised at. And, things looked good. But I had gotten into a pattern with getting with the boys on payday, you know, and we would stop on the way home from work on Friday on payday. I wasn't aware that banks cash checks. I thought that you had to go to the bar room to cash your check, and I would slide on into the bar room, and I would get a beer or two, or three, or four, you know. And I was also the kind of drinker that even after all those years of practice, that I could just drink so much. You know, I'd drink five or six bottles of beer, and I would get about here, and that would be it. I mean, it wasn't no sense doing anything to me because I just wasn't going to drink no more because I couldn't physically drink anymore. I can remember a beautiful point in my life. To me, it was a fantastic experience. I was 24 years old, and it was a Saturday afternoon. It was hot, and it was in July. Funny, the things you remember. But I'd left with a couple of the guys, and we had went over to the bar to drink a few beers. And I'd sat there that afternoon, and I had drank four or five beers. I don't know what it was, and I got to about here. And I thought, well, Pete, there's no sense in me hanging around. Yeah, I got to get going, you know. And I went out to go get in my car, and I walked outside, and that heat hit me in the face coming out of that air-conditioning bar, and I threw up. And all four or five of those beers just came up. And the first thing that popped in my head was, you better go back in and drink some more, you know. And I went back in, and I started drinking. And I drank, and I drank, and I drank, and I closed that bar up that night, and I got a six-pack, and I went home. And I went in all excited. My wife was in bed. I went in, and I shook her, and I said, "Hon, guess what? I can drink just like a man now." And I was proud of that. 24 years old. 24 years old. 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29. 5 years. I was sitting in my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, you know. And how that had occurred was that, this is strange, you people, you hear an awful lot about coincidences, and Joe talked about a few of these coincidences last night, you know, and how things happen to us. And in hindsight, I didn't realize this until a number of years in sobriety when I looked back and was able to see what was going on. I had became a weekend warrior. I was getting drunk a lot on the weekends, and I was enjoying it, and I was having fun, and I liked the action in the bar rooms, and I was one of those kind of guys who got taillights in his eyes. You know, I would walk into a bar room and order a drink, and I'd lay my dollar bill down on that bar, and I wanted something to happen. I wanted some action, and if I went in and laid my dollar down and you just brought me a drink and I drank it, I was getting the heck out of your bar, because when I wanted some action, I wanted something to happen. And that's why I was out there. And I would get traveling around all the bars, and I can remember being 29 years old, and I was setting up the Gay White Way. Funny thing about the, I was to revisit that, it comes later in my story, you know, but I was sitting in the Gay White Way, and just as you walk into the Gay White Way, on the left-hand side, there's a telephone on the wall. And I walked all the way down the end of that bar, and I sat there, and I drank, and I drank, and I was getting pretty drunk, and I was getting feeling sorry for myself. It was a Friday night again, and here it was. I hadn't gone home from work, and I know the wife was home waiting for me, and matter of fact, my mother and father-in-law were supposed to come over for dinner that day, and I was really feeling bad about what I had done, and I didn't know what was going on, and here I was drinking, and got a crying jag on. And I walked down to that telephone. Now, how this happened, I haven't got the slightest idea. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous before. Maybe, I must have somewhere, it must have been back there somewhere. And I called, and I got a gruff old guy on the telephone, and he didn't want to hear me crying. He went here like bull crap, and he says, "Where are you from?" And I told him, and he says, "There's a meeting up at your home parish." He says, "St. James Francis, Sunday at 7:30. You be there. Somebody will meet you at the door." And I said, "Okay." This was like about 11 o'clock at night. So I figured that I was in good hands, so I went back and finished off my drinking, you know. And I closed the bar up that night at 2 o'clock, and I walk on home, you know, I get on home and pull up in front of the house, go in the house, and the wife is standing there looking at me. And she said, "Donald, I think that you've got a problem with alcohol, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, and there's a meeting up at St. James Francis Sunday, and I want you to go." Swear to God, that's exactly the way it happened. This next part is really interesting, because there's somebody who was very important in my life, who plays a very important part in my sobriety, who doesn't even know it, but whenever I have an opportunity to share, I always tell the story about this guy, and he has not the slightest idea who I'm talking about, but he's in this audience tonight. My wife and I went up to that meeting, 7:30. A guy named Dick met me at the door, took me over, got me a donut and coffee, and set me and my wife down around the table. And there's a little old man sitting up in front of the room. Old man. I mean, this is the way it looked to me. This was an old guy, man. He had a little old goatee, and
He's a little red-faced, and man, he looked bad. I mean, he looked bad. He looked like he was 40 miles up that road, boy, I tell you, you know. And he started talking about, and this may be an exaggeration, and I'm sure he can correct me later, but it's too late. I've been telling the story for 17 years now, you know. But he talked about the 17 times they'd been institutionalized, the 8 and 9 automobiles he'd wrecked, the 2 and 3 families he'd been through, you know. And I'm sitting there looking at this guy thinking, my God, thank God people like him have got a place to go. I could not identify with all those horror stories. I had a beautiful home in a nice community. I had a fantastic job. I was making big bucks. I had 2 new automobiles sitting outside. 2 healthy, beautiful kids, well-dressed, clean clothes, food on a table. 1969. And he's telling all this story and everything, and I, you know, I just sort of went along with everybody, and I smiled, and I shook the hands, and my wife said to me after, well, what do you think? And I thought, well, yeah, it sounds pretty good. It's really nice. I'll probably come back up here next Sunday. You know, you do that when your wife's mad at you, you know. You do anything when your wife's mad at you. So I went on my merry way, and I didn't stop drinking. I did what Joe said, was I tried to control my drinking. I don't think I really tried to control it. I just sort of planned it, you know. Well, I knew when I could get away with it and when I couldn't get away with it, you know, and that's when I drank. When I thought I could get away with it, I drank. But after a while, I just wound up back in the jackpot. I would wind up in terrible situations, and I'm sure some of you people have been there, where I would walk in the bar with all the best intentions in the world. I know the wife's waiting dinner, but I also know that if I can just drink 1 or 2 nice cold beers, I'm going to be okay, get a little shorty on the side, you know, to give it that zing and get it going. And then I'll go on home, and I walk in the bar room, and I order myself a beer. I'm all by myself. I'm sitting there, and I get my beer, and I start drinking, and old Pete walks in. And Pete says, Christ, I ain't seen you in a long time. Why don't you have a beer with me? And Pete buys me a beer. Now, I ain't cheap. I can't leave her until I buy Pete one. And then Dick walks in and buys Pete and Don one. And then Pete buys Dick and Don one. And then Don's got to buy Pete and Dick one. You know, and that's what happened to me all the time. I didn't mean to do those things. I mean, I just couldn't be ignorant and walk out on those guys. You know, I couldn't understand. My wife couldn't understand that, you know. And before you know it, it's 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm coming home with the pizza pie as the peace offering. You want to hear one? This isn't, can you top this? I was sitting in the bar room one night, and I was all drunk up, and I did it again. You know, half my money's gone, and I did it again, and I knew I did it again. I wasn't that drunk that I didn't know that I was in trouble, and I was scared to go home. The biggest gorilla in the world could have walked in that bar, and I went nose to nose with him. Didn't care, but I was scared to go home. My home. And I couldn't go in there. But I'm sitting there in the bar, and I'm about half shot to the wind, you know, and I'm talking to this guy and everything like that, you know, and he says, you know what? He says, I got a couple horses for sale. I can let you have one cheap. I bought a darn horse. Only I buy it. He lent me his trailer to go get it 1 o'clock in the morning, and we go pick the horse up, come back to my house, and I'm thinking, boy, this will do it. She can't be mad now because I bought the kid the horse. And I walk in the house with the horse. Insane. You know, I mean, it's laughable and it's funny, but my God, the pain that was involved in all this kind of stuff. This took place between 1969 and 1972. Between 1969, everything that I heard of in that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous happened to Don Henderson. In recent years, we've had a little controversy down in the Baltimore area with the squeegee kids. Late in 1969, I was the fellow who started that movement. I was one of Baltimore's first squeegee kids. I used to live in a doorway. The home was gone, the wife was gone, the family was gone, the jobs were gone, the cars were gone. I'm living in a doorway and I'm a wino. And the cars would come up on the corner of, I think it was Fayette Street and Green, I can't even remember what it was, but I was living in a doorway there. And I would run out in the street when they'd stop at the red light and I'd spit on your windshield. and take an old dirty rag or something and wipe your windshield off to get a nickel or dime or quarter so I could go down and get me some Mad Dog, baby, you know, get my bottle going. I had a very wonderful, loving maiden aunt who loved me as if I were one of her own children, and she was fairly well-to-do, and she introduced me to the psychiatrist and the psychologist, and I started making the rounds of those people because they were trying to find out what was wrong with me. And I would spend hours with these people, and she was to spend thousands and thousands of dollars. I had one psychiatrist who gave me an open prescription for Valium because I suffered from this nervous condition. And it was a wonderful situation because I think that my aunt had such influence over this man with her money that all I need do, I don't care where I was to get on the telephone and call that doctor and tell him that, "Doctor, I really feel bad. I think I'm going, I don't know, I'm just all falling apart. I don't know what to do. I'm so scared and everything." And he'd say, "Where are you?" And I'd say, "I'm such and such a place." He says, "There's a Reed's drugstore down on such and such a corner. I'm going to call the prescription and you get right down there right away." And I would shuffle on down to Reed's and I'd say, I'm Don Henderson. Do you have any?" And he'd give me a big bottle of pills with 25 or 30 pills in it, 10 milligrams apiece. And I would eat some pills until I could get some money together to get another drink. March the 18th of 1972, I was laying in my doorway like I normally was. I was telling a couple at breakfast, if you can remember back or if you can get the newspapers and read about March the 17th, St. Patrick's Day, 1972, it was cold. I mean, it was colder than it is now. And somewhere during that night, someone had stole my shoes, which wasn't anything new. I had stole them from somebody to begin with. You know, it wasn't a big deal, but it was cold. And I woke up that morning and I was sick like I was prone to be when I came to in the mornings. And any good wino knows that when you've got that much wine left in your jug and you don't know if you're going to be able to hustle up enough money to get any more, that the first thing you do is sneak over behind Lexington Market where they got them big produce stands where a guy leaves that garden hose out all night, and you fill yourself up with water and you keep throwing up until you can hold some water down, then you can go ahead and finish your wine. I had 5 or 6 pills left in my pocket, and I remember laying in the doorway and I had drank my wine and I was eating the pills, and I don't know what happened, but I know this, that my mind at that moment was as crystal clear as mine is right now today, like this moment. And I couldn't get in and I couldn't get out. And I don't know if it was anything like a moment of truth. I don't know what was going on, but I know that I was stark raving terror, and I never want to forget this. And I remember cursing God that night. What kind of a God could it be that exists in this universe who would allow a piece of human trash like me, a person that does nothing but use and abuse and hurt people, allow me to live and take beautiful, beautiful people out of it? You know, poor little children just dying, and nothing made sense. And I had been down to the Grace and Hope Mission a couple of times, and I had been saved a couple of times, and a lot of things had happened. And when I was a young man, I had 2 years of minor seminary. I was studying to be a priest. And I had certain belief structures at that time that had just gone out of the window, you know, and I found it extremely difficult to believe in God. I had been introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1969, and let me tell you what it is that I learned about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous between 1969 and 1972. I said in a meeting one day, and a man said, "You suffer from a disease and not a disgrace," and that's the only thing that I ever learned. And I used that to my advantage. Every time that I would go out and get drunk and get in trouble, "Well, you know I got a disease. I just had a relapse, and I copped out." And I sat in those meetings, and I heard those people talk about God, and I wanted nothing to do with it. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous as a matter of convenience, just to get a hot cup of coffee, a couple donuts, the weather off my back for a little while, and it was easy to put the bite on people in AA. All you had to do was sound a little sincere, and I sure as hell could do that. You had to look at me. All you had to do was look at me, and your heart would just open up because I was so pitiful. You know, I was 112 pounds, and I got big ears anyway, you know. And Christ, they stuck out like sailboats, you know, and my eyes all bumped back, you know. I looked terrible, man. I was a hippie. I had hair down to my shoulders. I had wine sores all over my face, and I'm laying in this doorway, and I'm cursing God. I had got up earlier that day, and I'd walked down to Turk House was about three doors down from my doorway, going south. If you went north, it was a bar two doors away called the Phase 3. That's where I got my line, you know. I couldn't go in. I could stand in the doorway and hear the money that hit and wired up, you know. And I remember walking down to the Turk House that morning and rapping on the door because I knew in there they helped drunks. And they said, get away from here. Go on, get the hell away from here. And they pushed me away. And there was no place to go. There was nothing to do. And I screamed out, dear God, you know, God damn you, God. And just about then, an old guy come walking down the street. Wasn't an old guy. He was younger than me. A guy that I had met in Alcoholics Anonymous for, a guy who I had called, and he had come to my rescue many, many times, had called my wife and patched things up and all that kind of stuff. And his name was Chuck. Chuck came down and looked at me, and he said the magic words. Don, you want to try it again? Chuck, I'll do anything. You know, Chuck put me in his car, and I threw up in his car. Took me down to his house down in Severn, Maryland, beautiful home down there, and his wife fixed me a little something to eat, which I couldn't eat, but put me in his basement and put AA tapes on. Had a tape of Bill Burke. I never forget that, you know. I met Bill after that. And put this tape on and started planning, and he started carrying me to AA meetings. He went over to the telephone, and he says, when's the last time you've been home? Diane, know where you're at? And I don't know. It's been a few months, I guess. I don't remember, you know. So he calls my wife up. Diane, I don't want you to worry. Got Donald over here, and he's doing fine. And she says, you got him? This is the other side of the conversation, he told me. And he said, yes, he's right here. Well, you keep him because we don't want him, you know. And that's the way it was. And that's the way it was. I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and not a darn thing in AA had changed. Same people standing up in front of the room saying the same old dry bullcrap. Don't take a drink, can't get drunk. No shit, Dick Tracy. You know, and I'd go through all these kinds of things. But you see, here I was. I was the scared little 14-year-old boy again. I needed desperately to fit in and belong and be part of something because there was absolutely nothing else in my life and nothing else inside of my heart. I had no place else to go. Nothing to do, and they made me door greeter. You're going to be door greeter. I came into AA in the under 35 group over in Birmingham. A bunch of young guys. I was the oldest guy in the group. I was 32 years old when I came in. March the 18th, 1972. And they put me on the door, and I'm sitting at these meetings, and I'm hearing these things, and the new people are coming in, and I'm reaching out my hand and saying, shaking their hand and saying, man, ain't this a fantastic way to live? Ain't this AA wonderful? And I get the smile on my face and then the teeth. I bought these in AA. You know. I had a few, but they were spaced, you know. And I got these more in AA, you know. And I'd smile anyway, you know. I wasn't ashamed. I'd give a damn. You know, I was going to put bite on you. You know? And I'd tell them how wonderful AA was, you know. And I'd sit there, and I honestly, this is the gospel on the street. I felt halfway decent there. I really did. It was sort of like, it was like being back home with mom and dad, and they were taking care of it. I was sort of surrounded. I wouldn't have identified it as such then, but I think it was the love that these guys had because they really cared. And I would sit there, and we'd be there, and we'd talk, you know, and the meeting would be over, and we'd discuss this, and we'd discuss that. And then we'd leave the church, and we'd sit out on the front lawn, and we'd sit out there at 12, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. I didn't have no place to go. I was totally unemployable. No, and I was glad to be with them. And then after a while, everybody would start parting company, and they'd be leaving, and I'd be left all by myself. And immediately, the thought would come back into my mind. I wonder if your brother still got that gun. Remember the one you gave him a couple years ago so you wouldn't hurt yourself? I wonder if he's still got it, and if he does have it, will he give it to me? Because I might just as well blow my brains out, because this program is not going to work for me, and nothing else in this world has ever worked for me, and I might just as well end it all. I feel so phony. This is just another one of those big lies, another one of those things that you talk yourself into. I was sober 6 months in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. How I made it that long, I don't know. I guess it had something to do with it. I didn't take a drink. And my sponsor came up to me one day and he said, Donnie, he says, I'm getting a group of the young guys together and we're going down to Smyrna, Delaware to give a talk. And we'd like you to come and share. And, well, you can tell about my ego anyway, you know. Jeez, God almighty. You know, if I could hear your cold sores, I'd let you all run up here and touch the hem of my pants. You know, that's the way I feel sometimes. I feel this power, you know. And I love that. I thought, my God, I'm going to talk. They finally recognize the genius. And they want me to share my superior knowledge with them, you know. And I remember driving down to Smyrna, Delaware that night, and there's a lot of people in here who know my sponsor, and I'm not going to say his name because he told me not to ever tell anybody that he sponsored me. Then came my turn. They introduced me, and I walked up in front of the microphone, and a little podium like this, but like I say, about 20 people in the room, and I started sharing. And as I started to share, I started to cry, which is a no-no. I spoke for 20 minutes, and I cried for 20 minutes. I went back to my seat, can't tell you a word I said. Sat down, the next guy got up, and he spoke for 20 minutes, and I cried while he spoke. They put me back in the Volkswagen, they drove me all the way back to Baltimore, and I cried all the way back to Baltimore, and those guys paid absolutely no attention to me. I'm going, and they're talking, and going on, you know, anything like that. And they drop me off in front of the house, you know, and I'm walking in the house, and I'm crying, and I have never in my life seen any blinding flashes of light or seen any kind of a revelation until, well, I'll share one with you later, but it just happened one time. But at that time, nothing happened to me. Except there was like a little teeny thing deep down. It wasn't even a voice. It was a feeling like, you ain't had a drink for 6 months. Maybe this thing will work. Maybe you better ask them what it is that they're doing. You know, I went back to my home group that night. I got this guy in the back of the room, one of those sober members of AA, you know, the ones with the twinkly eyes and they, hey, you know, and they're jumping around and you know he's not bullcrapping. And I went back to him and I says, Dick, I says, what the heck are you doing? What are you doing that makes you feel the way you're feeling? I think this thing might work for me. What should I do? He says, Don, he says, I'm trying to apply the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And that floored me. That totally, it couldn't be that simple. There has to be some, I had said at meetings, and I must have read those 12 steps 1,000 times. I thought you were supposed to do them. I didn't know I was supposed to do them. I didn't know anything about that. Now, the importance of what I like to share is that I know that there are people sitting out in the audience today who are just like me. I looked at the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous, and most certainly I could admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I was powerless over a whole lot of things in my life. It was easy to admit that. The unmanageability was evident in my life. And to come to believe that a power greater myself could restore me to sanity, that didn't take much either. My sponsor simply said the healthy thinking, Don. Think of it as healthy thinking. And then to try to go and make a decision to turn my will and my life over to care of God, I knew I couldn't do it. I had been trying to do it for a long time. Now, these aren't articles of faith. These are just things that were, and I couldn't deny them anymore. I guess you call them conviction. So immediately that night, that Tuesday night, I began to apply the first 3 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And my life got 1,000% better. 1,000% better. I can remember being sober 1 year and the wife saying, you can come back in the big bed now. Year of sobriety. I can remember people in Alcoholics Anonymous saying, hey, Don, I have a little cookout over my house Sunday. Why don't you and the wife come? I'd love to have you. Yeah, they're important things to me. Get me wrong, it's been a long time since I've been asked to go anywhere with anybody, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, for a long, long time. And nice things started to happen in my life. I got totally immersed in my home group. I got real active. I put my name on a 12-step list, and I started working with new people and took jobs in my group and making coffee and all kinds of things, and it was fantastic. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. I looked at the 4-step. Fearless, searching, moral inventory. Right, left it out right away. I couldn't do it because it wouldn't be fearless. You know, and I justified that for a long time. My sponsor, who's very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and who is a great believer in the steps, and he also believes in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, would say to me, "Don't you think it's about time you worked that 4-step? I said, "I did." He said, "What do you mean you did? I don't remember you calling." Look, you know that I'm a Roman Catholic. I went to a little priest on the other side of town who I've got a lot of confidence in, and I did my 5th step with him. Now, I don't know if he believed it or not, but he didn't say that he didn't believe it. But I convinced myself of it, that it wasn't necessary for me to do those things. And after about 3 years of sobriety, I started to have a few people who would come up. You know, it's not hard. It's not hard to stand in front of your home group or stand in front of a group of people and talk about spiritual principles that you hear other people talk about. And you can even, if you're a phony like me, say a lot of things with a lot of conviction. It sounds like conviction. Talk from the heart, not from the head. You know, I always talk from the head. I just phonied up the heart a little bit so that you would believe me, you know. And even every once in a while, I would shed a few little tears, you know, just to help you out, to let you understand that I was spiritually superior than most people. And after 3 years of sobriety, and I'm going around, and I'm being Mr. AA, and I'm riding my white horse, and I'm saving souls, and I'm carrying drunks to meetings, and I'm taking drunks to institutions, and I'm doing all kinds of things like that, the action, you know, and I'm making coffee. Action's a magic word, they said, and I'm into action, man, and I'm doing it, you know. People started asking me to sponsor them, and I started sponsoring them, and, you know, if you talk this stuff long enough, and you talk about beating on the table and saying, "The 12 steps is the answer," the darn people that you're sponsoring start doing them. I don't know how that works, but they do, you know. And then one night a guy calls you up and says, "Don," I say, "Yeah, I got my 4th step down. I'd like to take my 5th step. Can you come over?" And you ain't did it. And you say, "Uh-oh." "Sure, I'll be right over. Don't worry about it. It's no big deal." And I'd go over and I'd sit and I would listen to their 5th step. And I would prompt them on, because the directions in the big book says immediately go to the 6 to review, go to the 6, do 7, 8, make that list of people, do 8 and 9, you know. And I would tell them all those things. 4 years, 11 months, 23 days of sobriety. I'm down in Virginia Beach at the Oceanfront Conference. And a lot of things have been going wrong in my life for a long, long time. And I'm not talking about the external things. The things came back. I told you, I got me new teeth. I got me new eyeballs. You know, I got glasses in here. And I started putting the body back together. And I started to buy myself some nice clothes. I had some bucks in my pocket. I was back to work. The family was back together. My wife was active in Al-Anon. We were doing a lot of social things within Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to gain the respect of my family, my brothers, my sisters, my mothers, fathers, aunts, uncles. Everybody was saying, "Look at that, Donald." My uncle calls me up and said, "Don, I want you to come over and speak in front of my Boy Scout troop about alcoholism. Would you do that?" "Sure." And I'm doing all these kinds of things, and I'm going to hospitals and high schools, and I'm doing all that stuff. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. 4 years, 11 months, 23 days. And I knew. And I knew. It wasn't the things that happened in my past that hung me up. None of that hung me up. I had heard enough of it in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had shared enough of it one-on-one in the backseat of automobiles. And this is by no means a formal 4th and 5th step. But what I mean to say, that I had an opportunity to look at these things, and it didn't hang me up. But I was such a phony in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was such a cheat and such a liar and such a user and abuser of the responsibility that was given to me, that I begin to think about, why don't I go talk to my brother and see if he's got that gun that I gave him a couple years ago. Because this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is no different than any other thing that I've involved myself in my life. I do nothing but use and abuse it, and I'm no good to anybody on the face of this earth. Because I am the same man, and I will drink again. And I know that I'm going to drink again, because I'm going to drink tonight. The hell with it. Funny thing about that convention, one of the speakers couldn't make it. And they asked another guy to come up and speak in his place. And this guy got up on the podium and he started talking, and he started sharing some of the things that was in my heart. He was telling my story. And I heard bits and pieces of my story all the time, but he was talking about a guy being sober 5 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous who refused to do it. And he touched me. And I don't know where the courage came from, but I went up to him after the meeting and I asked him, Phil, would you talk to me? And he took me up on the roof, up on Orange Roof in that hotel that we were staying in. We sat up till 5 o'clock in the morning. And we got it straightened out. And I say things like, you know, but Phil, I feel so phony. He said, Don, the reason you feel phony is because you're phony. It's okay. You feel what you feel because that's what it is. What you're about here in Alcoholics Anonymous is change. And Joe talked about it so beautifully last night, and he really got me on fire. Because I am one of those table pounders in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous who goes around beating on the table. Talking about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The difference between Joe and I is, Joe will allow you some room and I won't give you none, damn it. Absolutely none. If I'm working with you, you're going to do them. And I don't care if you understand them or if you don't understand them, because you are playing with your life. And I was playing with my life, and I know the agony and the pain, and I don't care what it was that you saw that looked so nice. And if you were my neighbor, you would look over the fence and you say, that Don's got it going, man, I tell you. Nice wife, kids, nice, everything is going so super. And I was dying on the inside. I was putting up that phony front. I was able to do the fourth and fifth step, and I was able to continue on and do the six and seven, and then my life really took off, pal, let me tell you. It got fantastically beautiful. I put the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life to the best of my ability. That wasn't the end of the story. I mean, I haven't lived happily ever after. This is an ongoing thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the program of AA is a process that I continually go through. And I've heard a lot of things in AA. But I have a responsibility as the person who is up here sharing with you today to tell you the truth as I see it. And you're going to hear many different views of the truth, because each person has to share it the way he feels it in his own heart. And my responsibility is to tell you the truth. And I don't mean to be any kind of a teacher or arrogant or anything like that. And if you feel that, that's okay, because I know where I'm at, and that's fine too. But if you want to recover in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you must apply the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in your life. It is an absolute must. I have gone to meetings where I've heard people say, and I have absolutely no argument with them, but I couldn't do it. I had just never been that darn smart. Don, you work the first 9 steps, you set them on the side, you maintain your sobriety with 10, 11, and 12 in the maintenance steps, and that's a fantastically beautiful idea. But do you think for one moment that my concept or my vision of the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't changed in the past 17 years? It most certainly has. When I sat down that first time to write that fourth and fifth step down, there was a big lump of fear inside of me, pal. Even though I had worked the third step to the best of my ability to prepare myself for doing it, there was still that big lump of fear. I literally, on a yearly basis, make it a point to walk through specifically step by step by step by step. And anybody that I work with in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is going to do the same thing. Whether they're fooling themselves or not, it makes no difference to me. They're going to do it. Wisdom is a byproduct of action. All that you know about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous don't mean nothing. It's what you do. And everything that I knew, and I studied the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for 4 years, 11 months, and 23 days. so I could impress you with my knowledge. I wanted to be known as Don the Big Book Man, like Stan Lee used to be over in the Washington area. And nothing would happen, and I darn near die. When I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 7 years, I want to tell you this experience because it's important. And I've just recently began to share this with people. I was sober 7 years in AA, and my wife had been sick with cancer for a lot of years, and we had been through a lot of situations, and she, you know, lots of surgeries and chemotherapies and everything. But in 1979, we went through the final thing. She had a tumor removed from the side of her brain, and it left her totally comatose. She couldn't flutter an eye, move a finger. It was everything that she could do just to breathe. Her breathing was extremely labored. And the doctor told us, you know, that she probably wouldn't live another 30 days and it was going to be over soon. And her and I had prepared for that. Now, this is all okay. Don't get me wrong. This isn't one of those tear-jerking stories. It's far beyond that. It's a very spiritual experience for me. I was sitting next to her bed one night, and I was reading to her, as normally what I would do for a little while in the evenings, you know, and I'm sitting there reading a book, and she reached out and grabbed my arm. Here's where the blinding flashes of light come in, whether you want to buy it or not. And I turned and I looked at her, and her eyes were open, and she was just, her eyes were beautiful and they were crystal clear, and she said, "Don, I have to go home now." And she died. And it was beautiful. I felt the very presence of God. And it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. Now, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they make a statement, and I can't quote it verbatim, but I'm going to get close. There comes a time in every alcoholic's life where he has no mental defense against the first drink. I went through that trauma, and I suffered all the things that loss gives everybody, you know, the little craziness you go through when you lose a loved one and things like that. And it's tough, and I signed up for classes out at Sinai Hospital to help me get through it. And I had two teenage children. And I did a lot of wrong things, you know, which equaled guilt for a while, but that's all okay now. My 17-year-old son wound up getting arrested for manslaughter. My 13-year-old daughter ran away from home. 3 months later, my brother died, and I'm looking around saying, "My God, you know, I'm sober now. Hey, son, here's what's happening here, you know, and all these things are happening." And we got through that thing, you know. And I didn't take a drink, didn't think about taking a drink. But there came a time with 11 years of sobriety when I had absolutely no mental defense against the first drink of alcohol. And you know where I went? I found myself with 11 years of sobriety sitting down the gay right way on a bar stool with a ginger ale in front of me with a cherry in it and a straw. And I'm swiveling it around and I'm looking around at all the crazy sickness that's going on around me. And I'm thinking to myself, "My God, what is the use? You might just as well take a drink and get it over with. Oh, hell, you know." And they're telling you, "Think a drink all the way through. Think it through." And I'm thinking it through. And I'm seeing the newspapers. I was in the newspaper business at that time. And I'm seeing the headlines, you know. And I see my picture, you know. And they're taking pictures of me where I'm falling out of this automobile in a wreck on Hanover Street Bridge. And this crazy woman's laying on top of one of these prostitutes or something with me, you know. I'm doing all the things that you're not supposed to do. And I said, "Who cares? I don't care. I can't do it anymore." My sponsor used to say, "Don, the biggest cross is for the biggest horses." And I just wanted to cry. I don't, you know, I just want to be a little teeny pony, doing them little miniature jobs, none of these big crosses. Why is this happening to me? And I got up and I got out of the bar. I don't know how. Sober blackout, they call it. Got my car, drove 22 miles to my house, walked in my house. It was a house. It most certainly wasn't a home, and it hadn't been a home for a lot of years. And I walked in, and I walked into my bedroom, And I fell to my knees at the foot of my bed, and I started to cry, and I said, "Dear God." And that peace and that serenity that I experienced 7 years ago, that the moment my wife died, came again. It came again. And I've been pretty good since then. Just sort of not even walking around in fear, waiting for the next shoe to fall. You know, it's been pretty good since then. But I have some convictions in my life today, rather than opinions. My number one conviction is that I know the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. And I know that God is. I know that God is. I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 17 years, and I'm going to close right about here. And what I'm going to share with you is something that saved my entire life. When I was a brand new man in Alcoholics Anonymous, I went over to Spring Grove State Hospital, and I was sitting out in the front row out there, and there was a little old man standing up in the podium, and anytime anyone's standing at the podium and they're talking to you, they always look like they're looking right at you, you know, and pointing their finger right at you, you know. And this guy's pointing at me. I don't know if he was pointing. Seemed like it. His finger was about that big around, you know. And he said, "If you don't believe, make believe. If you don't believe, make believe. If you suffer from what I suffer from, and you are in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're not drinking and you're living in the delusion that your problem is alcohol, you will probably go to your grave and never know what the hell is wrong with you." Many years ago when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm saying, "You guys don't understand. What do you mean don't drink? Don't you understand that for me to just breathe, I have to drink? You can't tell me that alcohol is the problem. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that the alcohol is not the problem. Read it. It's in there." When I stopped drinking, Joe said it so beautifully last night, when I stopped drinking, I had to do something else. We have a program of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's called the 12 Steps of AA. Wisdom being a byproduct of action, you will never understand it until you do it. And even then, it ain't going to be too clear. We have a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that gives us the solution to all our problems of everything that ever happened to us. And there's a chapter in there called Chapter 5, and it says how it works. And for 17 years, I've been reading that book, and I ain't figured it out yet. And I'm going to have to keep coming back, and I want to thank you all for having me, and have a real nice weekend, and thank you much.
Once again, my name is Marty, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Don very much for a terrific message. I hope you all had a nice meeting. I think you came here to help yourself. I'm sure you did, but you damn sure helped me an awful lot. We have an awfully, awfully nice way of closing.